The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 17th of March, 2020. On the podcast today, Simon Potter, Chief Executive Officer of Bahamas Petroleum Company. And Simon provides an operational update on their schedule and funding for their Perseverance 1 well. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin news. We also talk about the markets mainly, though, just this coronavirus outbreak and what's going on, and the fact that we were chatting about it, you know, before it actually started falling. Also on the podcast, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you could see both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon Potter, Chief Executive Officer of Bahamas Petroleum Company. BPC is the ticker there. Simon, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. Depends where you are. Morning, afternoon for us, morning for you. But So you've released two bits of quite significant news in the last few days, and we'll dig into that in a bit. As we do, as always, Simon, if someone's listening, of course, there's a clue there in the title, but just tell us about Bahamas Petroleum. What's happening there, please?
Okay, we've got licenses, 100% licenses held in the Bahamas adjacent to the Cuban border, where we've shot 3D and we have very large, massive structures. And so our obligation is to drill an exploration well during the course of 2020, targeting one of those structures, but essentially with a target of 800 million barrels to 1.4 billion barrels for that well, like I say, 100% BPC.
Yeah, and you've announced a slight postponement of the project, about doubling the facility. So why has the schedule changed, Simon?
Well, our obligation is to drill a well in the Bahamas in 2020, and we've spent 8 months or so gearing up for this event. And we had anticipated being able to get underway in April, but we've really just adjusted that schedule to more late May, early June. This is obviously as a result of the potential disruptions that we'd have due to the coronavirus. But also, we've had a number of announcements over the last 6 months outlining our sort of financing strategy, where we've prioritized our shareholders. We've received backing from individuals who have backed us before with convertible facilities. Most recently, we announced that a local family office in the Bahamas were supporting the project. And indeed, as of yesterday, we announced that that facility had been doubled up to £16 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how will this, you know, this sort of a postponement, how will it affect the operations there?
Well, I mean, obviously, coronavirus and the COVID-19 is affecting everybody. It's unprecedented in terms of its global scale. It certainly wasn't foreseen by ourselves or indeed planned for. And the drilling operation is obviously a complex project. We need to get people and equipment and suppliers all together in the same place at the same time. And we draw on these from all over the world. We need to operate safely, but most importantly, continuously for about 45 to 60 days. And put simply, in the current environment, we just couldn't guarantee that through April. The effects of having to sort of halt or stop the program in sort of mid-well plan would be financially sort of catastrophic. So, you know, with all of the world's governments imposing quarantine and travel restrictions, it's almost impossible for us to guarantee being able to get crews to the rig, and indeed equipment to the rig, as and when we need it. And even a few days delay could amount to millions of dollars extra to the cost of the well. But, you know, when I've spoken to you and the shareholders before, we've talked about this being a massive logistics exercise, and that logistics exercise just simply cannot be executed in the way that we envisaged it at the moment. But I think over and above that, you know, there are real health and safety concerns. The rig has up to 200 people on it. It's just like a cruise ship. People are in close confinement, and diseases can spread. So certainly we would put precautions in place. We would obviously need to protect all of our people and our contractors, but in the April timeframe, it just couldn't be guaranteed at this stage, and so we delayed until the May-June timeframe.
Yeah, and do you know what? It is phenomenal. It's affected pretty much everyone in the world. You know, I've never known anything like it. And when you're up against sort of Mother Nature like this, it's unbeatable, you know, for a certain amount of time. And that's the trouble. We don't know how long. So, I mean, you know, I even saw Trump being asked last night, how long do you think this is going to last? And he didn't really know, and he guessed. So what about, you say that time now, you've got a time frame there, but what about the chance of further delays?
Yeah, well, we're obviously planning in the same way that everybody else is. There's contradictory information. We're just trying to do the best job that we can. At the moment, what we're anticipating is a peak in the next sort of 8 to 10 weeks, and then it sort of tails off after that. And that's what underpins our planning for sort of May or June. But like everybody else, we're monitoring the situation. We're talking to our contractors and suppliers. And what we are trying to be is as flexible in our response as possible. I'd remind you that our obligation is to drill in 2020 in the way that we were managing the risk with regard to coronavirus in the short term. If we leave it too much longer than May, June to start the well, then we're entering into the hurricane season here in the Bahamas. So whilst it's certainly not our plan at the moment, we've got contingency to begin operations again in October, November to execute the well consistent with our obligation. So we're trying to be fluid. It's a fluid situation. We're planning to respond to whatever we see before us at the moment. We're certainly planning on May, June, but certainly there's backup plans for, as I say, October, November time.
Yeah, and what about the sort of impacts, you know, of that on funding and costs there?
Well, there's no real impact on funding. Obviously, the announcement yesterday saw great support for the project team, and it certainly was the sort of fillip that the project wanted and needed at the time. So our funding strategy, as I've outlined, is to have the funds available as and when we need it. At the moment, that's prioritised for April, but then May, June and July. And so our funding is certainly secure at this stage. In terms of costs, what we've invested in is the long lead items. So these are bits, casings, wellheads, and these will be needed whenever we drill. So they're stored in warehouses at the current time, and whether we sort of mobilise in May or whether we mobilise in October, those costs are secured and in some ways are recycled as and when we start to drill.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Simon, as always, if someone's listening right now and likes the sound of the project and they're not yet following the company, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox.
Sure.
And add you to the watch list, please.
Sure, I certainly will, but maybe I'd just like to say that...
busy.
Sorry, that's the rig. Yeah. Let's keep perspective. You know, we're talking about an oil well here. It means a lot to our shareholders. It means a lot to me. I've been at this for 10 years now, and any delay is frustrating. But certainly our health officials are facing life and death situations, and our governments are dealing with unprecedented situations. This is a big situation that we're trying to deal with, and we're doing our best. Yeah. The good news is that rocks have been out there for millions of years. So 2, 3, 6 months, it'll still be there. In the greater context of how long we've been at this project, then, like I said, let's keep perspective. Now, as to the sort of three things that you asked me about, well, those three things would be, to me, stamina. The team's together. We've been together for a long time. We've been together through many ups and downs. This is another turbation that the project has been given, but I think we've shown ourselves to be committed and robust. Options. The second thing would be options. We've expanded the facility. We have cash in the bank. And indeed, we haven't even spoke about the fact that we're still talking to companies about farming and continue to do so. And then finally, scale. I keep saying this to you and indeed your listeners, but the prospects are huge. These are billion barrel prospects. And like I said, they've been in the ground for millions of years and they'll certainly be there for another 2 to 6 months. Now, as I sat and reflected on those three words, stamina, options and scale, accidentally, it spells out SOS. Now, that's simply a function of the three words. Those sentiments are still there. Stamina, the people are together. Options, we've got cash in the bank and support from our funders. And indeed, the prospects are huge. So those are the words I would use.
Marvellous stuff. Simon, thanks for that, fella. And hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Indeed. OK, thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn, the good man. And he's a crypto trader, but he's also... In fact, are you actually trading crypto at the moment, or are you just standing well back? Stand back.
I'm standing back. I'm standing back, Justin. Mm-hmm. It's over the past... week or so. You remember we talked about quite recently, well, first of all, we were saying, could Bitcoin be a safe haven because it's uncorrelated with stock markets?
Yeah, well, first of all, we were saying originally, about 4 weeks back now,
yeah,
why is the market paying any attention to this coronavirus? Because we've known previously viruses, yes, have a massive impact, and we don't know. Because the worrying thing about viruses is, like we are now, we were always behind the curve on it. But the time, yeah, we get the figures, the 24 hours behind, the virus is travelling on at breakneck speed, spreading, so you never really know where you are with it. And so we were saying, why isn't the market reacted? And then all of a sudden, about 2 weeks after we started mentioning this, it did, because we had cases in Europe. Like, you know, yeah, it's almost like viruses know, you know, they know about borders and control. They won't leave China. It's fine. A virus will. It's not allowed to leave China. It hasn't got a passport. You know. It doesn't happen like that with viruses. They travel anywhere a person will travel. You know. So
would you remember? I did that tweet ages and ages ago. Even before we were talking about, even before sort of a month or so ago, when we were talking about those our predictions and frustration that the market hadn't crashed yet when it clearly should. But you remember before that I did a tweet. I'm just scrolling back through my tweets right now. All right, I don't know. This was March the 2nd when I did those predictions of the exponential growth in number of cases outside China. And I was sort of saying that based on the current growth at that time, from March the 2nd, within 2 months, practically the whole world would be infected, or most of it. And at that time, I didn't quite believe that either, but I was just going from the extrapolation of the curve, and you were just like, can this possibly be true? Surely not. It's amazing to think now, only a couple of weeks ago, it still seemed pretty much impossible that the virus could grow at such a rate.
But it's not near your figures of 8 million, is it?
In terms of actual infections, surely it is.
No, we got, hang on.
Wait.
183,000 we're on.
Right, and guess what? I'm looking at you can check the tweet right now, but it says 1 week, 40,000 cases outside China within 2 weeks, which is about where we are now.
What do you mean?
Because this was March the 2nd. This particular tweet was on March the 2nd. And it says within 2 weeks, 200,000 cases. And you've just said 180... whatever it is, cases. It's pretty close.
And yeah, what's next week on your thing?
1 million.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that was... back then, things were basically rising by a factor of 5 every single week.
Well,
I don't think it's quite that fast now.
At the time, I thought that was really over the top. But, I mean, you say it could happen. Like I said, the thing is now, we are all taking precautions, hopefully, that will slow it down. You know, unchecked, it could have got there, probably. But... what I'm worried about...
Yeah, that was more like China in the sense that... Because even when I tweeted that, the total cases outside China were rising far, far faster than the total cases than the total cases inside China, because China had already clamped down by that point. So, yeah, hopefully our little curve there will start to flatten out pretty soon.
Yeah. This is my worry. And this And I don't want to frighten people, but I think we're already 2/4 of contraction on GDP is called a recession, as a technical definition. Yeah. Now, this quarter, we definitely aren't going to be growing. Everything's shutting down around the world. And I think quarter two probably now. And in fact, you know, look at this. Volkswagen is to suspend production in Europe. Volkswagen's the biggest, I think, biggest car manufacturer in the world, pretty much. So that just shows how deep we are into this. All the airlines are shutting down, pretty much. They're asking for bailouts because they've got no money. But what I couldn't understand yesterday, I sent a tweet out yesterday, I said after that Downing Street thing, saying I thought they were going to be doing a sort of health and, you know, economic sort of support package kind of thing. Because you can't just say, let's close, don't go to restaurants and bars and all that stuff now. You can't just say that and then not have some kind of support mechanism financially for those bars and restaurants. It's not their fault.
You know, no, absolutely. I completely agree with you.
I mean, he did sort of allude to something happening in the background, and apparently today the Chancellor is now coming on and showing. And this is their, and I said on the, just tweet to us now, this is their chance to step up, because we are in recession, and what they do today, the depths on the, or the how much they're going to support businesses will be directly related to how long and how deep the recession will be. If they have very little support or underestimate the impact, it can go on for a long time. Now, if they get in there and try to do their best, you know what, guys, you only have one chance pretty much in government. This is your big moment. Really is. You're probably not going to face any bigger challenge than this. They've got to really get the bazookas out and say,
and what's more, I mean, obviously the support to businesses is probably, well, apart from, you know, health is the number one issue. And then support to small businesses in particular is probably the number two most important issue in the UK. And quite frankly, things are moving so fast that what these sentences that we're saying right now will probably be obsolete by the time most people listen to this podcast, because, of course, they're going to make announcements. They're going to have measures today. They need to be massive measures, as you say. But aside from that, probably the third most important thing is actually the pound, which, as you'll probably have noticed, has been tanking ever since it became clear that the UK was not bringing in stringent measures as quickly as other countries. And what was interesting was that after Boris Johnson's announcements yesterday about finally he was bringing in proper social distancing and encouraging everybody not to go to restaurants and all the rest of it, the pound didn't pause for breath. It continued to tank. The markets were not convinced by what he said yesterday. So you're quite right. What they announced today about support for small businesses and so on could be not just really important for small businesses, but also really important for the direction of the pound, which currently is, I mean, you know, it's almost in, you could say, in crisis, really, against the dollar. It's absolutely just plummeting fast every day. Let's have a look. Only about 3 days ago it was at 128 to the dollar. Now it's at 122. You know, this isn't just the pound falling, this is the pound plummeting. And I think Boris Johnson needs to pay at least, I mean, when I say he needs to pay attention to the pound, frankly, by saving the British economy, he would also save the pound simultaneously. It's obvious what he needs to do, isn't it? A massive package of fiscal measures.
Yeah, but absolutely. Cause if you just look at it, right, let's say there's a person and there's lots of people working in the hospitality industry, service industry. Let's say you work in a restaurant or coffee shop or something like that. You're not highly paid. You're maybe renting, you're on a mortgage. If you are now, first of all, that your business would have dropped off massively after even before that anyway, but that was the cliff off the cliff moment where he just said, you know, don't go to restaurants and bars. I thought, what? You can't just say that without supporting them. So yeah. your business, that if it's an independent, that's really worrying, because they probably have, I'd say, at the best, maybe a month's worth of cash reserves to pay you. Less than that, most people will have a week, 2 weeks maybe. So you'll probably be asked to maybe redundant or asked to take non-paid leave. And people can't afford to do that. So those people then can't pay their rents and their mortgages.
That's right.
So then you either get a landlord who will not get their rent, who also probably has a mortgage as well, so that mortgage will get knocked, or they can't pay their mortgage. Now, straight away, it goes back to the banks and the financial system. And so the government will have to step in here and say to the banks, you were bailed out in 2008. Right now is your chance to step up, and you've got to help out. Cancel mortgages, cancel rents, everything. Anything that people are owing that's been knocked by this sort of thing. Because otherwise, we're going to have a domino effect there, and then the economy is going to be crippled. And so, you know, it will go really badly unless these guys really step up today and, you know, get the guns out, the massive weapons. They could use everything they can to stop this falling over, because it'll have a domino effect.
Exactly.
It can last for a year. This is going to depression. It could be a 2-year recession, you know. That'd be awful for everyone.
And obviously the government can, you know, even in these times, the government can still borrow money at insanely low rates of interest. So, you know, if the government needs to borrow a ridiculous amount of money in order to bail out all these businesses, then that is something that it can do. There's also the question, of course, the thing that all the kind of gold bugs and hard money fanatics have been banging on about for decades. Maybe their sort of worst nightmare slash the thing that they've most been looking forward to is about to happen, which is the monetization of debt. You know, governments now, because they have to do such enormous bailouts for small business, well, and large businesses, like the airline industry that we're expecting to be helped today, for example, in order to finance that, they will be very tempted to just monetize debt, to basically just print money and never unprint it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I'm just looking now. Stephen Mnuchin, the US secretary there, is to seek a package of $8.5 trillion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, either that goes on the government's balance sheet, or thinking about, well, maybe we should just cancel all this. Maybe we should just, you know, the temptation will be there to just go to the computer and just rub out the figure. And then that's all you need to do in this day and age. You don't need to actually burn any banknotes or anything, do you? You just, that's all you do. God, I don't know. Exactly. I don't know. I think crazy things are going to happen in the world of money.
It comes down to this, right? It's about real people or made-up stuff, you know? And real people are going to suffer here. And the government debt is made-up stuff. That's what it comes down to, what I think. And I just think, right, do you know what? Start doing it now. Government debt is fine. It'll always go out. It's fine. Do you know what? But these people, you know, are going to suffer for a long time unless you pull your finger out. And we only have one life, pretty much. So let's try and make people's lives a bit easier. And don't worry about government balance sheets, because they can keep going. You know, look at Japan. They're like, with 200% in GDP, they're fine. They haven't, you know, as long as you're standing living, it's fine over there. It's fine. We don't worry about the stock market too much. As long as you're standing living, it's fine. It's all right.
But don't forget, Japan, just a quick thing, Japan has got a unique situation in the sense that most of its government debt is held by citizens in a sort of semi-patriotic way, I understand. So it's quite easy for them to finance 200% of GDP as debt because their people will do it, whereas most other countries rely quite heavily on overseas governments and companies and people to help finance their debt. So it might not be so easy for everyone else, is all I'm saying.
That's a lot. You've got to get out that big. 8.5 trillion. That's so much money. That's literally. I worked out, I did a thing. There's a thing on, just even envisage how big a trillion is. You know how, if you put a trillion into a trillion seconds, do you know how much that is? Have a guess.
No.
It's 31 years. In seconds, so it's 1 trillion. That's how much it count. That it would take you 31 years to count up to 1 trillion. That's nuts, isn't it? and these guys come for $8.5 trillion of package.
Makes the whole, you know, when you think about austerity over the past decade or so, you know, and George Osborne's attempts to, we've got to get, you know, the fiscal balance just right. Oh, I'm afraid we're going to have to shave off a bit from police budget here. And, you know, it all seems so pathetic now.
It is when you're talking about human lives. And during that, you know, when you've got services like that, there's so much need, like the NHS, all the support services like that, you know, the police, emergency services, and you're trying to lop off a bit here and there. You can sod off.
It was just like fiddling while Rome was about to burn, though obviously we didn't know Rome was about to burn, but that's how it feels now. Just worrying about minutiae all those years and causing pain to the police service and to the prison service and the other things that were kind of constrained financially, and all the while it seemed, you know, I can see the argument for it. I was not a fan of austerity and austerity policies, but at the same time I could see the idea behind it, and that from a certain point of view it did make sense, and that maybe I was wrong and maybe it was the right thing to do, who knows. But now, with the hindsight that we've got now, is where we just, you know, throw ridiculous amounts of money is what's about to happen. And it just seems pathetic, really, doesn't it? The whole austerity thing. Like, what a, Yeah, I don't know. I've only just said it 1 minute ago, but I'm repeating myself now. But I'm just kind of amazed by what a waste of time it was.
It comes down to
a decade of us all worrying about nothing.
Yeah, and thinking about, you know, you realise that if you, the old golden rule, you know, treat others as you'd like to be treated. And I just think, you know, if you're in that position and you say, oh, we've got to cut the budget in the police, would you actually do that to someone else? Or, you know, would you like it done to you, the way you're doing a good job, an honest job, you're working hard and all that stuff, and yet there's pen pushers around in the government just trying to lop off a bit of money here and there and think, you know what? No. I think there's more ingenious ways of raising money the government can do that, rather than just cutting essential services, you know?
Yeah.
So that was...
I think how important the Office for Budget Responsibility became. Oh. You know, oh, they're going to make sure that everything, all the figures balance, that'll be fine. Well, I wonder what's going on in the OBR today.
Today, the markets, I see the Dow Jones, it's like literally, it's fallen non-stop pretty much. They're down around like 30% now from their recent highs, the S&P, the UK FTSE. But yesterday was down almost 3,000 points. And today, futures turned positive, and ours turned positive as well, but now we're back in the negative. Because I just think, you know, as we go along, we realise we can make this, try and make this. Because let's be honest, if you look at China, if you look at Italy and Spain, the figures yesterday were coming down. It's not a trend yet, but they're starting to come down a bit. So if we can contain this to 3 months and the support packages are put in place, we can deal with it. We can be in and out of a recession quite easy. But if they let us drag on and try and penny pinch, then it's going to drag on and it'd be awful and miserable time for a lot of people. And
The stuff that I've read, you know, in the past couple of days from, you know, immunologists and virologists and epidemiologists gives the distinct impression that whatever we do, this is going to drag on. They may lift certain restrictions, but then they'll put them back in every time the rate of infection rises. They're going to bring down the restrictions on going to restaurants again.
Hang on, Glenn, hang on a second. The guys yesterday, there's only one person so far, isn't it? Or there's very, very low incidence of reinfection, very low. And we've got, what I hated about this, right, is they were using, someone sent me a really complex link about what the British government are doing about modelling and all this stuff. And in terms of their models, were pretty much based on previous viruses. And I thought, hang on. I said, I've read a lot of stuff there. It's very complex. I don't understand much of it, to be honest. There's a lot of text I was reading, most of it I didn't get. But what I don't understand is this. Why are they looking at previous models when we have a real live model? You know, why are they not looking at the China model, South Korean model? Putting them all together, say, okay, China's got some different factors there because they're locked down the city. South Korea's got some factors there. But literally look at those models. And now they realise, oh, hang on. They said yesterday, look, the adoption, the strategy that they adopted, they said it was having a catastrophic sort of effect, and the figures were rising a lot faster than they realised, and so now they have to really clamp down and lock the population down a bit more.
That's why it has to drag out, the flattening of the curve, because our NHS hasn't got much space.
But every other country was doing that, locking down populations, right? But we are experts saying, no, we're looking at the models, and now they've sort of admitted their models are a whack. Then the figures in the last 24 hours has gone nuts. And we'll see a massive uptick in the figures. That's where they're starting. I think even more, they'll bring even more stringent measures in. Schools will be shut by the end of the week, guaranteed it pretty much. And you know what? I think, you know,
it was pretty predictable that would happen. I don't understand why they.
We had a live model. We had people like Bill Gates for years saying, you know, viruses are one of our biggest problems. We need to put more money into fighting viruses. We can't. And he said it several times. We are basically defensive. When they come along, we can't do anything. We have to really pump some money R&D into it. And nobody
listened. Nobody cared. They were all too focused on climate change, which is apparently a far more urgent problem.
People like that, which
is astonishing to think now, isn't it?
Well, that stopped people flying around the world anyway. It stopped the CO2 levels going up.
That's true.
But, you know, people like Bill Gates made it to the top. Not by fluke, by luck, or Jeff Bezos. Now he's hiring. Jeff Bezos's business is actually one of the only businesses that's flourishing in this environment. You know, I mean, there are obviously health and business, but you realize a strong business is a strong business. And now he's employing 100,000 people more. He's raising wages in the UK and the US because you can't cope with the deliveries. And I heard a guy on CNBC say, "Why didn't Trump the other day just say, right, I want to get Bill Gates on this with his team because he's been funding viral sort of, research for a long time. And also get, Bezos on the
because he hates Jeff Bezos, doesn't he? They've got some kind of feud.
Yeah, now they're speaking though. But he said now, people are speaking to each other because he's helping. He's helping out. But get Bezos on the kits delivery. You know, the coronavirus kits. Get them delivered via Amazon. Get Gates on the research side of it. And he should have brought people together like Saudi and you know what they're called, Saudi and Russia, but they all dispute because that didn't help either, the sell off, because they had a big falling out and stuff. And generally, you should have hooked up with Europe rather than just banning flights from Europe. Just he didn't even tell them. They're one of the major trading partners, and he just didn't tell Europe at all. He just was stopping flights from Europe. I was like, this guy's he could have really brought the world together rather than divided it in that meeting right then, you know. But he just decided, right, we're shutting in with Europe because we're doing really well. People are dying in other countries a lot more than our country. We're great. And that's all he said, tapping himself
on
the back.
Well, this is the problem with, you know, when they elected Trump, you know, we all knew what he was. We all knew what kind of character he was. And my feeling was always not everything's going to go to hell because of Trump, which is what, you know, most liberals were saying. You know, I'm fairly liberal myself, but nonetheless, I could see that there was a chance that Trump would just, you know, be relatively ineffectual, do a few things, keep the economy chugging along, and maybe everything would be okay under Trump unless something dramatic happened. There was a crisis. This is the crisis, and a crisis, of course, brings out, or it needs to bring out, all the leadership qualities in a true leader, and a crisis tests a leader's character. And of course, now that there is a crisis, we see why it was a bad idea to elect someone like Trump in the first place, because he's a selfish idiot. Basically, that's what it is. He has, you know, no concern for no kind of feelings of world unity, which is exactly what we need at this point. We need him to be kind of rallying the World Health Organization and the UN and, you know, getting everybody working together on a sort of simultaneous kind of lockdown situation, not everybody acting independently, which is suboptimal. But unfortunately, as you say, he's not that kind of guy. He was brought in as an America First guy, and he's being an America First guy, and this is not the time for that, unfortunately. So yeah, now the Americans finally see why maybe it wasn't such a fun idea to elect the guy who just says a lot of rude things to people, because it's kind of fun and it shakes things up and it makes a bit of difference from the political norm. You know, when you get a crisis, you need the political norm. You need standard kind of leaders, not kind of crazy ones.
In fact, what you said there, America First, because he's been the opposite of, you know, globalisation, isn't he? He's been America First. And in fact, if anything, it's taken a virus to bring the globe together to realise, hang on, we have to share resources and information on this to beat this, because it doesn't care who is fighting against a virus. It's fighting against all of us, you know. So that's one thing we all have in common, is that we are its enemy. And that's an ideal opportunity for him to reach out, and he didn't. He missed the opportunity. He didn't spot it. In fact, there's an excellent documentary. Did I tell you last week about Dirty Money on Netflix? And they've got a documentary on Trump. And you just think, how the heck did he get to where he is? Just phenomenal. It's like the guy is really, he's one of the biggest, you know, it's called Confidence Man. A confidence trickster on the people who sort of con you, basically. They call con men, you know, Confidence Man. And it's on him. And you think, wow, he's one of the best.
He is the best in the world. He's amazing at it.
I know.
Read Scott Adams' books if you're interested. Scott Adams, the guy who does the Dilbert cartoons. I've read three of his books that he's written in the last sort of 5-10 years, and they're all about persuasion, how to persuade people about doing different things, manipulation, not necessarily how to manipulate people, but he sort of explains the psychology of all these things. He's an expert at it. And he's been a big fan of Donald Trump from day one, because he sees Donald Trump as the arch persuader, like somebody with incredibly instinctive persuasion abilities. He didn't even need to be taught how to be a sort of Derren Brown figure. He is naturally one of those people who just knows what to say to different groups of people. The weird thing, though, about Scott Adams is that because of that, he is actually a massive Donald Trump fan. even though he doesn't agree with most of the guy's economics or politics, he's so impressed by his persuasive abilities that he wants him to be president again, which I think is probably a mistake. Having said that, I mean, we don't want to get too much into a political discussion here, but you know, when you look at the opposition, if Biden is going to be against him, and let's face it, Biden is looking pretty shaky in... I don't know, how can I put it in a polite way? I don't know if you've seen all the various millions of clips of Biden that are going around, but his age is showing very strongly, shall we say. And, you know, he just might not be a viable candidate when it comes down to it. So Trump could win again for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
That is if these people all survive the coronavirus, of course.
Yeah. And finally, exactly. Do you know what? It's surprising how old all the candidates are in America. You see America portrayed... America is portrayed to us on TV as a young, vibrant, sort of, you know, fit, healthy country. And yet the presidential campaigns candidates are all above 70. You go over there and there's a massive instance of obesity. You think, well, hang on, we've been sold a lie here. And the streets look smart, flashy. And, you know, going on, even in LA and places, even the sidewalks and the roads are a bit sketchy, you know.
Biden and Sanders, both in their late 70s, Sanders has had a serious heart condition. Biden, we know, is, you know, very doddery at the best of times. Trump is only a few years younger and is obviously, you know, has obesity issues, which he claims are not an issue, but we know medically that is a risk factor for coronavirus as well. And then there's just Elizabeth Warren sort of trailing behind, and she's in her 70s as well. So, you know, is anybody going to be left after this coronavirus to actually stand for election?
Finally, any of the last word on Bitcoin, Glenn?
Yeah, let's quickly. I mean, you know, just to quickly update people, because I've talked in the past on here about my investment strategy over the course of this whole thing. Yes, as you pointed out at the beginning of our chat here, me and you were both talking weeks and weeks ago, more than a month ago, in fact, we were saying, why on earth hasn't the market crashed? So obviously we were both kind of expecting it. I had my portfolio insurance, you'll remember, some put options, which protected me when stocks started falling. I also moved heavily into treasury bonds, which rocketed for a while as US interest rates came down. But then treasury bonds started reversing themselves. So even they started being dragged down by the stock market crash. So I sold out of treasury bonds sort of quite near the top. So I did well there. I was selling my shares progressively from the top. And so, you know, so financially I've come out pretty well from this, all things considered. You know, I've got more money than I had before it all started. And I'm proud to say that that's not due to shorting the market as I did. I've told you about that before. In 2008, I wrote an article about it in the Times a few years ago, about how in 2008 I shorted the market at the right time and turned £3,000 into £100,000. Now, I have not done that this time, partly because I would have felt terrible about making money out of the coronavirus by shorting the whole market. So where were we? Okay. So I'm
what are you saying, Dad? Basically, I've done well. You guys were burned tough.
I'm not saying...
You may be crying into cornflakes. Do you know what? I'm not laughing.
I moved into treasury bonds. There's nothing immoral about putting your money in US government debt, okay? That's how I've made most of my
money. Do you know what
comes
back to me, though?
Good. I've been, you know, if I was an American, I'd be a patriot right now for buying all those treasury bonds. So there you go.
But you know what? I had a couple of people have a go at me on Twitter because I said, you know, after we had a big dip, so luckily I had some cash on the thing, about 30-40% cash, and I've sort of gone up on and I've sold into rallies, so I've now up to six. In fact, equity values have gone down, so my portfolio percentage cash now is around about over 60%, and so
that's good. I'm nearly all in cash now as well, and I have been for about a week or two now.
I'm not bragging about my cash level. I'm just saying.
It's sensible.
People had a go at me. No, hang on a second. I'm just saying people had a go at me because they thought I was smug. Because I timed it right. I've got really, you know, and I've seen people saying, oh, what's more smug than people saying how much cash they've got after the stock market's fallen? And I said, listen, no, It's not. It's, but if you want it, I see this. This will be a hard time for, you know, for many, many people, and it's horrible being fully invested in this level, at this level, because if you want to outperform the market, you've got to buy these. You know, when big sell-offs happen and you start turning around, the best returns come out of recessions. You know, so you've got to be prepared for that. Now, I go back to, and I said, listen, there are several things happened before the corona. Someone said, you predicted the coronavirus. I said, no, I didn't. I didn't at all. The thing is, U.S. stock markets are at their high for a long time, and I went through periods of being really bearish to being okay, half bullish, half bearish, then really bearish again for like 2 years, and then we had this inversion yields, the yields inversion. Inverting last summer, and they said generally this is a very good predictor of a recession, and they normally come about 18 months after the yield curve inverts. That was back in the summer, so that's the end of this. So look how good that was, really, and this is before the coronavirus came around. But now with recession's nailed on, some people say it was going to happen anyway because of the yield curves, but it's definitely going to happen now. But also you had, you know, earnings coming down, but the markets in America are rallying like crazy. They're all-time highs. So they couldn't justify the earnings. The valuation has been stretched. You've got Warren Buffett going to cash on the ratio he looks at, which is the GDP to market cap of America there. And so there were many sort of, and gold was rallying. You know, you had many sort of indicators outside this coronavirus. And this came along, and then it was the catalyst that broke the back of the market, you know. And so you have to be, you know, your eyes have to be on the macro as well a little bit to just, but I think next time, anytime we have to come out of this again, and that yield curve, the 3-month 10-year yield curve, it's worth looking at, worth keeping an eye on all the time, and just then being cautious when that,
I mean, yeah, know, the signs were there. I know we've got to finish shortly, but I have a bit of audio that I actually clipped up for believe it or not, from more than a month ago. You know, the discussion you were referring to where we were saying, why on earth haven't the markets crashed? I'll just play it quickly, and you should be able to hear it.
Is it me?
You said earlier, but
you
know what?
Surprised why the markets haven't blinked on this as much as
I just find it just remarkable and terrifying.
Me too.
And I have done all week. I just find it insane. I can't understand it. I constantly try and read stuff that can explain it to me to make it make sense. It just makes no sense. If anybody ever tries to tell me again that markets are rational and react to fundamental information and news, I'll just laugh in their face, because it's just nonsense. What the reality about markets is, when people are bullish and the market's in a roaring bull run, it takes more than a massive epidemic to stop people being optimistic. So there's the clip. And indeed, it took more than an epidemic. It took a pandemic to stop people being optimistic.
I'm getting myself in the background, coming back.
I'll just turn my headphones back in. There you go.
Is that just another bit of you saying, see, I told you so, that's why I'm in cash?
Yeah, kind of, but more to the point, we were talking about it on the... No, listen.
I told you I was right.
The point is, the signs were there. Me and you were talking about them a month... what's this? More than a month ago. 11th of February, that was, okay? Yeah. And... I feel we're in danger of rubbing it in. That's why I wrote a book, okay? I educate people about trading. Think you can learn lessons, right? I've made enough massive expensive mistakes in early on in my trading career. But the point is, you can learn from them. I learned from them, and people need to learn as well. and, oh God, you're right. I sound awful, but it is important that people learn the lessons from what's happened here and don't repeat the same mistakes in future. When the signs are there in future, feel free to sell your assets and get into cash, or to move into treasury bonds, or to do whatever seems sensible. But don't just assume that stocks will just keep on going up and up forever and that every little dip is a buying opportunity. That is not always the case. Every decade or so, we have a total nightmare of some kind. And you have to be prepared for that nightmare, because if you hold your stocks throughout every single 50 50% or more decline that happens every decade or so, you're missing out on a hell of a lot of potential gains that you would get if you sold near the top, waited the year or two for the 50% to 60% decline to happen, and then buy in again at the bottom with all the spare cash that you will have. That's, you know, that's what I do, and that's what I think everyone should do, and I'm kind of evangelical about that. I know it's probably the wrong time to be saying it, as you say, because it kind of sounds a bit smug at the moment, but as
well, it's hurting. A lot of people are hurting. I got into an argument with someone, and it hurts people because they lost a lot of money. They're sitting on, you know, a portfolio that's down 60%, and literally, yeah, it hurts. It's even, I can't even switch on some of, no, but I'm 60% in cash, and even look at the stocks I have, but I'm 40% in, you know, these stocks, and I'm down, yeah, on those, but, you know, that stock level's gone down about 40-50%, and it hurts to even look. And even though I got a good chunk of cash in there, it still hurts to look at my portfolio. And so I hate to sort of say this, but I mean, you know, and it's really annoying. And I got two mates that are not sold on a WhatsApp group. They don't sell. They ignore what I say, pretty much. And I hate to say it. And then they'll say, what's happened to this stock? I say, are you still holding that stock? So why are you still holding that? I told you I sold that stock a long time ago. Why are you still holding it? Or some of this. And then I just said to them just now, I said, do you know what annoys me? This is pees me off, and it's going to pee you off more. And it's this, is that we're coming up to a time in the stock market history where it's going to produce one of the biggest opportunities you've seen in the last decade, or maybe decade and a half, yeah, or even two decades. It's coming up the best opportunities, and you don't have cash. And that's really annoying. And I don't know how to solve this. And you will not do very well if you don't listen and learn. Because this right now is going to be a massive opportunity, and you can't take advantage of it. And that's what annoys me. And it makes of mine, and it hurts me a little bit. They're just sitting there on big losses, and they can't take advantage of this upswing, which is really annoying. And I think part of you.
Absolutely.
When we start getting through
it's
this, we
crucial
get
crucial to get it.
Yeah.
Crucial to sell near the top and buy near the bottom. You know, and I'm a long term. When it comes to stocks and shares, you know, you call me a dirty trader when it comes to Bitcoin and cryptos, and I am more short term with those. But with stocks and shares, you know, I'm a long term trader, right? But I buy and sell every peak and trough. So, you know, that's selling in 2000 and buying in 2003 and selling in 2008 and buying in 2009 and now selling in 2020 at the beginning of 2020. And I'll buy. No, and this is crucial to point out to people, actually, because we're bound, and I'm sure you agree with me, we're bound to see an enormous rally, a bloody massive rally at some point soon, because that's just what always happens when you get a sort of vertical decline like this. I mean, we saw just on Friday, we had a 10% rise, for heaven's sake, one of the biggest rises of all time. And now it looks just like a blip on the charts since the declines that came after it. Mm-hmm. But the point is that at some point, we will get a massive rally. I mean, I'm guessing probably 20%, something like that. And everybody will start thinking, this is it. This is the recovery. But we know, again, from stock market history, it probably isn't the recovery. It's probably a bear market rally. Mm-hmm. If we rise, but we don't rise all the way back up to the top, then you can safely say that's probably a bear market rally. And in fact, you know, perhaps a good opportunity for people who regret not selling their shares, perhaps to sell their shares after that rally or during that rally. And, you know, the real bottom in nearly all stock market crashes comes much later, months later, sometimes even years later. So you've got to be patient if you're looking for that main buying opportunity. There is only one exception that I know of to that rule, and that was 1987, when the stock market crashed very suddenly in much the way that it did this time. It just fell off a cliff, and then it started recovering almost immediately and just slowly climbed up. Within 2 years, it was back to where it was before. So that was the one time when what I'm suggesting didn't happen. And that does worry me. It worries me a lot that if I wait for the proper bottom, what if we're in 1987 again and there is no second bottom? It just climbs from the first bottom and just climbs relentlessly. That is a worry. But as I say, that was a one-off. So I'm going to put my money on that not happening this time. I don't know.
Yeah,
what do you
think? I'm scaling. Sorry, I've got 40% in stocks. You know, I'm 60% in cash, 40%. So I bought yesterday. I topped up in three funds yesterday. On big down days like that, I'm going to keep topping up. And I bought two stocks. I bought a new stock, which is in antimicrobial sort of infection control and all that stuff. They've got big contracts in the NHS. They're growing anyway. They're called Tristel. They're very profitable. They've got excellent profit margins. They could generate lots of cash. They pay a dividend. And they were quite bullish on their set of interims up to December 31st. They're growing very quickly, 20%. 20% revenue growth and 20% profit growth. And they'd only just started mentioning COVID then. I think now, wow. It's, if anything, first of all, they're going to get uptick in sales. Secondly, the awareness now to viruses and the protection against them will go through the roof. So this company's going to do better. So I bought Tristel yesterday. I also topped up another company called MPAC, and because I just think these companies have lots of cash, they're generating cash. And I say, if you're going to buy a company at the moment, make sure, first of all, it hasn't got debt and it doesn't need cash, you know, and that's two things. But I mean, I'm already topping up, but small, little bits, incremental things. And I won't go full on tilt in until I realize there's some positive turnaround in figures of coronavirus coming down.
There are a handful of stocks that are still looking strong because obviously they make money out of this situation. Ocado, who I've mentioned before, are actually almost back at their all-time high, believe it or not, which is astonishing to think during this decline. But they are. They're almost back at their all-time high share price. So, you know, there are actually a few stocks out there that I mean, if it's doing this now, what will it do when stocks start rallying, I wonder? Will it just absolutely rocket along with the likes of Clorox, who are an American company that make disinfectant? Their stock's almost at an all-time high as well. I don't know. I mean, these are kind of one-off opportunities, but when I talk about buying the bottom or near the bottom, I'm talking about buying the whole market. Like, you know, if you're the kind of person who buys index trackers or whatever, I would suggest there's a lot longer to wait before we hit the true bottom of the situation.
I mean look at the stats, like I said, last thing, because we've been chatting enough nonsense. If you look at the stats on the last 22 bear markets, the average fall was 36%. We're now around about 30%. And the time it lasted from peak to trough was 335 days. We're literally about 30 days in. And it doesn't keep going all the way down. So we could go down 40% now, but it could bump along the bottom for a while before it starts picking right back up, you know. So, if we're going to conform to the average, even if we're faster than the average, we're still nowhere near half that amount of days in. So it's going to be a while. And that suggests to me, you know, bear markets are the start of recessions, which last for a while, you know. So
Quite exactly. This won't be over immediately. Before I go, quick word on Bitcoin, because we haven't really mentioned it. Just very, very quick, which is Bitcoin, the idea of it being a safe haven has been pretty much rubbished now, because like everything else, including gold, it was dragged down by the stock market. Mm-hmm. In times of panic, everything correlates negatively. Correlates positively. Everything goes together. Yes, you need to be in cash or treasury bonds. But as I say, even treasury bonds started being dragged down by the stock market, which is astonishing. Cash is king in situations like this. Bitcoin is not cash. It's not considered cash by the world at large yet. And that's pretty clear from the fact that the price of Bitcoin has been dragged all the way down to around about $4,500. As I speak, it's back up to $5,200, which is, you know, at least an improvement, but might just be temporary. We have not yet hit the major bottom that it was hit in the crypto winter of 2018, which was around about $3,000. Bitcoin's price hasn't quite reached that low yet, and maybe it won't. You know, there's a possibility that it's now, you know, hit the bottom or hit near the bottom again for the second time and will rise from here. Is a possibility that I'm keeping my eye on, because obviously it'd be lovely to catch the bottom of the wave. Or alternatively, people might just lose all faith in Bitcoin in this crazy environment that we're in right now, and it could fall even further. You know, I'm open to that possibility. So currently I'm on the sidelines. I'm not owning it, and I'm waiting for an opportunity to buy it if it shows significant signs of an upward turn.
Marvellous. Cheers, Glenn. And we'll, if we're still all here, of course, then... then obviously we'll speak to you next week.
Okay,
it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five, BP. course, a lot of the oil companies have been sold off. What's that at the moment? It's down 5% to 245. At four, it's Instem Group, down 5.75% to 426. At three, Royal Dutch Shell. And that's, what is that? £10.20 or £10.17. It's up a little bit, 1.4%. It's been heavily sold off, though. At two, Vodafone Group. This, do you know, it's amazing that people are now going for the bigger stocks in the sell-off because they've had a hammering as well. And, you know, you can get the kind of returns you can get from small-cap stocks when these rebound or bounce. Okay, Vodafone Group is just 1% of 98 pence. And number one most followed company is Barclays at 80 pence at the moment. And that's 9% down. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Xerox Technology, development agreement for microplastic filtration. At four, Kibo Energy, Mast Energy developments and Bordersley update. At three, Columbus Energy Resources, corporate update. At two, Eddie Stobart Holdings, it's a holdings company. And at one, it's Horizonte Minerals, business update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.